Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Anita Hill is our guest for most of this hour of the program. She has a new book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. It's a wide-ranging book that looks at the subprime mortgage crisis. It looks at what the president must do to enlarge our concept of home for all Americans. She has a fascinating chapter on Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun, which I remembered vividly in play form initially, and then the movie. She writes about Abigail Adams. She writes about female pioneers who were slaves who sought refuge in the Western United States. She writes about the whole history of owning your own home in the United States and how race and gender play into that and make it difficult for owning your own home for certain people in this country. She writes about a lot about the subprime lenders who have targeted to race and to women as well, and looks at the information that supports that. And she writes pretty movingly about her family and about black women particularly having a history of searching for a place to call home. We, of course, can't speak with her without talking a little bit about Clarence Thomas, because it's been 20 years this month that charges of workplace sexual harassment against then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas were front and center. Legal scholar Anita Hill was front and center in that, as you will recall. She detailed in her earlier book, Speaking Truth to Power, her experience as a witness in Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. She is a professor now of social policy law and women's studies at Brandeis University. She is the youngest of 13 children. Ain't that something? Grew up on a farm in rural Oklahoma. She received her law degree from Yale. She worked in private practice and for the federal government in Washington and joined the faculty of the University of Oklahoma College of Law. She is with us and we'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Anita Hill, a great pleasure to speak with you. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Ms. Dunn?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm excited to be talking to you and hearing from your listeners with their questions.
Yeah, we'll have a lot of callers for you, I'm sure. Let's start with this whole, because it's still front and center, and it's part of the reason that people are incredibly upset in this country and occupying Wall Street and other streets all over the country and all over the world, and that's the mortgage crisis and the subprime crisis, which you detail pretty extensively in your book. Can you talk about how the subprime lenders targeted minority people and targeted women?
Well, as a matter of fact, that is a critical part of the book, because I really did love your summary, and it is far-ranging. But central to the theme of the book is the idea that home really bears a strong relationship to equality. And so the targeting of women and people of color and communities of color was especially poignant and compelling when it happened during the foreclosure, the subprime lending spree, as some people call it. What happened was that we have this whole history of racism and sexism in lending practices. And in about the mid, around 2004, 2005, new devices came on the market that were supposed to help people who had been outside of the housing market to help them enter the housing market. Well, many of these devices later turned out to be toxic devices. They were spread throughout the market, but initially, I say they were tested out on in communities of color, disproportionately, and then if you read the transcript of some of the lawsuits that have been filed against lenders, you will also find that women of all ages, and particularly elderly women, were targeted for these kinds of lending devices. So it wasn't just that individuals were losing out economically. For women and people of color, the loss was really their chance at the American dream, the chance at attaining this symbol of equality that so many of us have aspired to own. And that's what I try to capture in the chapters leading up to my discussion mm-hmm. of the subprime lending crisis.
And you tell the stories through wonderful stories about human beings. I'd like for you to spend a little bit of time because it's such an amazing story, and it also involves Anjanette Booker, whose story appeared on the front page of the New York Times some time ago and captivated you for a number of reasons. What is her story?
Her story is the story of a woman who was divorced and a mother of a daughter, and who was out on her own, starting her own business as a salon, hair salon operator, and who wanted her own home. Not surprisingly, she wanted a place of safety and security so that she could raise her daughter and continue her life. And she went to a lender that she had used before when she was married and got a loan. And it turns out that the loan was one of those loans that the payments escalated in. And this is a typical story of so many people. She did not know that this was going to happen. She recalls being told that she was going to get a conventional loan, and that was not the case. She ended up with mortgage payments that more than doubled after about 5 years of having made payments faithfully. Her mortgage payments more than doubled, and like so many people, she couldn't afford it. And that was the story that appeared in the New York Times, and it told about not only her having suffered through this. It was 2008 at that point, but it told about any number of people in her community that was experiencing the same. I tracked her down, though, and found out that really her whole life story was a compelling story of survival. And I discussed how she got through this maze of a problem and now continues to own a shop and contribute to the community as well as own her own home.
You write that when stories like hers first came to light, there was a widespread presumption that the victims of the mortgage crisis were to blame for their troubles. That probably you could look at other situations in your life that were applicable, you know, mm-hmm. the same kind of perception here. How did that come to be? It's like the welfare queen thing that happened some years earlier. You know, you didn't read this carefully enough. You shouldn't have ever gone out for the loan, blaming people when predatory lenders probably should have been examined more carefully.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think that in part we wanted to blame the individuals because we didn't want, as a community, to take collective responsibility for this problem that we should have known was going on. We didn't want to think that the government might have had a role in allowing banks to issue these kinds of lending instruments without being regulated. We didn't want to believe that, in fact, years and years of discrimination against women, in particular in communities and people of color, we didn't want to think that there were vestiges of that kind of discrimination that was still being visited upon people. And so I think it was just easier for us to say, well, it's an individual's fault. That is, until the problem grew. And now we can read, there was a story in the New York Times today, I mean, you can read it almost every day in the newspaper mm-hmm. across the country about individuals who have gotten caught up in the same situations. And now we have to confront the fact that we can't just blame all of these individuals and think that that's going to get us out of this.
Mm-hmm. Anita Hill, what is the message? And you implore him to do something at several points in the book. What does the president need to do to enlarge our concept of home for all Americans? What should he do?
One of the first things that I do is to say that we need to have a better understanding, a conversation about what all of the issues are that were related to this latest crisis. That it's not simply a matter of let's restore the cost or the housing market, and then we'll all be doing fine. Because if we do that, in fact, there will still be vulnerable populations, and they will, over the course of time, still be subject to loans and agreements, lending agreements that are not in their interest or in the interest of the country to have. So we need to start looking at this as a complex problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires really a recognition that there are a variety of policies that have contributed to it. There are regulatory problems when it comes to consumer lending. Some of those are beginning to be addressed with this new agency that has been established under the Obama administration. But that's only the beginning. There are all kinds of policies that led to the creation and the defining of neighborhoods that then were targeted by lenders for toxic loans. And those need to be addressed. Those policies that have to do with where jobs are placed or what kind of transportation is available, all of those policies need to be taken into account. But specifically, I suggest that there be something called what I call a home summit, that we really engage the public in understanding what we need to do to move ahead and restore people's security in their own homes and communities.
Do you expect a lot will come? I was interested in the suit against Wells Fargo and those targeted communities that were targeted by banks outside this country, too. And there are actions taking place in Baltimore and in other cities, even in Milwaukee, to take those people to task for what they did and to ask for some money to get the rats out of the unoccupied houses now that some have become drug houses because of what these institutions did. Is that a growing thing?
As one article that I read said, entire communities are now up for sale. Entire communities mm-hmm. are up for sale. That means that you've got abandoned buildings. That means that people have left. That means that communities are losing all kinds of economic and social capital. Yes, in fact, I do think these lawsuits are important and critical to help recoup some of those losses that the cities are suffering, and in particular the state of Illinois, where there's a suit against Wells Fargo, an entire state is suffering. And I credit the Attorney General there for recognizing that. But I don't think that it is enough, because, as I say, in Reimagining Equality, a few suits against one or two banks is not going to restore us back or put us back in a place where we need to be as we move forward into the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
It will, you know, even if we restore the market at this point, we still have to deal with the fact that individual wealth has been lost, and that is going to have an impact on their children, the
sure.
children of these individuals. So what are we going to do for those children? One example, many individuals, many parents have been using the equity in their homes to help borrow money to send their children to school. Now, with the loss of that equity, for some people, it's thousands of dollars. With the loss of that equity, they're not going to be able to use their home to help send their children to school. There are figures that the Pew Trust has given us that say that minority groups have, in fact, lost as much as 65% of their wealth.
Isn't that awful?
In this recession.
Right.
And most of that can be attributed to loss in their home.
Yeah.
And so how do we then recover from that? And simply restoring the housing market is not enough.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that's why a lot of people are going to Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Madrid and saying that without knowing where it's going to lead. I am very upset.
And make no mistake, these are all interrelated issues of what happened when, specifically with homes and housing, income did not increase at the same rate that housing prices increased. And therefore, people were having to work harder and harder just to put a roof over their head. And this was particularly acute for single women, who many of whom are the sole providers for their children, and many of whom will spend as much as 50% of their income on their home. And so if you take that into account, then you realize that these inequalities that the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Boston are protesting really are not just in the abstract. They have practical impacts on families and will have a practical impact on children for the foreseeable future and maybe even beyond. And that is what I want people to really closely examine through this work and to take note of, and then we can work together to figure out how we should all respond, not just President Obama, but how all of us can get engaged and respond.
Anita Hill is our guest, and her book is Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. She now teaches at Brandeis University. She was at Oklahoma for a number of years. She's a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University and came to national attention. As you'll recall, those hearings were riveting 20 years ago this month, in which she detailed her experience as a witness in Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. All right, to your phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. And we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone calls now for Anita Hill. Let's go to Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Marvelous topic, and your guest is an important voice.
Yes, she
is. Very good work.
Thank you.
I would like to make a point that I think is slightly contrary to the position that Ms. Hill has. I think that there's an argument that although there are unique vulnerabilities for women and people of minority status defined one way or another, and notably Black America, that we're in a situation where that vulnerability is not restricted to people and individuals based upon race or gender, but it applies to the population as a whole. Not to be original to 99% of us. And
well,
so that...
Can I stop? I'm not disagreeing with you. We are in agreement.
You wouldn't.
We are in agreement. I absolutely know that at this point in our time, where we're looking at the crisis and we read the stories in the paper, we are talking about millions of Americans. We all have a stake in this. The only distinction I would say that the experience has for communities of color is that we're really talking about sections of cities like in Baltimore and Memphis and in the state of Illinois that are identified as Black or African American and Latino communities that have been devastated. And I would simply say that what is at stake for those communities if they are going to survive, is different from what is at stake from some of the suburban communities that I'm talking about. And many of the families who reside in those communities are headed by single women. And so you're absolutely right. This is a crisis that everyone is facing. And that's why I think we should all be engaged in this conversation.
Yes, and we should recognize a common cause and that there are institutions and interests that view us all in the same way. And so there may be those who are whose vulnerability is greater, but we're all in the same situation. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for making that point and clarifying it for the listeners.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Deepak in Appleton. Hi, Deepak. Hello, are you there? Call us back. Sorry, David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Yeah, when you brought up the whole Occupy Wall Street, another thing entered my mind. These people with 1% of the wealth, they've got that way because they can own many shares in these companies. Maybe I have a suggestion for everyone out there in Wisconsin. Start doing as much businesses with co-ops and credit unions because most of those is one person, one share. If every company in America was that way, it wouldn't be that 1% owning all the wealth.
Anita.
Well, let me just say this. You know, I don't know the entire history of banks or banking in America, but you know, before I took over, I came here at Brandeis, I did teach some in banking, and so I have a little bit of a background, background in social history to know that, in fact, very early on in our country, there were local banks that were prosperous in communities that really were individual contributions or co-ops. And, you know, there was a model of a bank where people knew that their interests were going to be protected and that they had a shared interest in terms of investing their money and that the interest was also very local and it was very community-oriented. Those have become smaller or fewer in number, I should say, as larger corporations, like larger banks, like Wells Fargo, have really sort of taken over the market. And there's a whole history about that, and we won't bore everyone with it. But you're correct. One of the ways that we can start to address this is to start thinking about local investing of our money in smaller banks and banks with more of a local interest and community interest.
Mm-hmm. I need to talk to you a little bit because I think this is amazing. Time had a piece on you a couple weeks ago. A lot of people have had pieces on you in the last few weeks considering the 20th anniversary.
Oh, I hope I haven't overdone it.
No, you haven't. You're a very important person in America, and you know that, and it's good to hear from you again. But I was amazed. You talk about after you testified at the confirmation hearings, letters began arriving in your mailbox at the University of Oklahoma, which is where you were then, as many as 4 trays a day, each with hundreds of letters. You have had about 25,000 letters in the 20 years, and you've kept all of them. Why have people written to you, Anita? What do they say?
They write about everything. They write about their lives and their experiences. And initially, of course, many of the letters were stories about sexual harassment. But people write about their belief and vision for America as a much more egalitarian place, as a place where inequities, whether they're economic or racial or gender inequities, where they become less and less important, and it's very exciting, it's very encouraging. There are two things that I let me just say, as of late, I get more emails now. I even got telegrams back in 1991, and of course that's gone. And I say now that the emails are the new telegrams. But the emails that I get today now talk about the meaning of home that individuals have, and and how perhaps their elderly parents feel because they are struggling, and what it means to them as children of elderly parents, and what it means to them as parents of young children. So I get a whole array of letters from women and men, and they're all really helpful to me in understanding how strongly people believe in this country and how strongly they believe in fairness and equality.
Has all that you've been through, you're so composed and kind and a lovely person to talk to. If I had been through what you've been through, I think that I would be a little torn up inside and probably part of me a bit angry. But you don't seem to exhibit that.
Well, I'm sure somebody who knows me who's seen me exhibit anger. but you know what? I understand what anger is, and I also understand how destructive it can be and unproductive it can be. And so, yes, I have my moments of anger, and I've really attempted to deal with them, but I really also have a lot of faith. I tell people faith and grace has gotten me to where I am now. And I attribute that to a large extent to my upbringing and if I could just do a little tribute to my mother, one of the things that she taught me was to understand when something was wrong, understand why I might be angry, and then tell me to, okay, now you can move on. You have to move on. You cannot be consumed by it. If you want to go on and do what you can do and be productive, you cannot let all of the things that have gone wrong consume you.
Right.
And so I have carried that throughout my life, and I try to live that way, and it doesn't mean that I don't lapse every once in a while, and I don't even think of it as a lapse. I think it's healthy, but it's not healthy to carry it and let it control you.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean you've let go of Clarence Thomas? Do you follow his court decisions at all? Do you read the news about him, or do you not do that?
Well, I do read the news because I'm a lawyer, and he is a member of the Supreme Court. I don't. People say, well, what do you think of his opinions? I don't do any analysis of his opinions because I do know that I cannot be objective, so I can't give you a legal analysis of what he does and says. I know that there are plenty of people who do that, and they have my blessings in doing that. But I don't try to isolate myself from the experience entirely of 1991. It was a critical event
yes.
in my life.
Yes. And you'll be remembered for that in so many ways. It was such an important moment in your life, really.
Well, it was an important moment. And when I look at all the messages that I've gotten since then, when I think about what the public was able to do in response to those hearings, if you think about the laws that were passed since then, you think about the cultural change that occurred after 1991, if you think about changes politically that happened in terms of women's representation in the House and Senate after 1991, you cannot help but be encouraged. And that's why I am really a strong believer in public engagement and really engagement, even if it's of a minority of the population, a small percentage of the population, I know that we can move the country forward. Have we solved all of the problems of sexual harassment? No, indeed we haven't. But in fact, we have come a long way in 20 years, and it has meant that we are that much closer to equality, gender equality in particular.
Yeah. Let's go to Ann in Platteville. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And, Ms. Hill, it's an honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Ann.
I would like your opinion about what I'm puzzled with about is I remember the savings and loan scandals that occurred back, 15 years 20 years ago, and people were prosecuted for their handling of that, as opposed to the way that the subprime mortgage lending and subsequent bank failures, et cetera, has been handled. And I'm wondering, what's the difference?
One of the differences, I believe, was that in the era of the 80s and 90s, many of the regulations that we might say would lead to some kind of prosecution for fraud, many of those regulations were lifted. And so I suspect that that's one of the reasons that we don't see government going after individuals now, because perhaps they're just more difficult. That doesn't mean that that won't happen. But you're right, it was much quicker then. And some of those prosecutions went forward and some were not successful. But they were significant, and I think they sent a very strong message. And I'm certainly not ruling that out as a possibility even after this. One of the things that I do in, I believe, it's chapter six of the book, is to talk about the behavior of the banks. And I talk about Wells Fargo specifically because that's the lawsuit and that's been filed, or that's the bank that has been sued in three different jurisdictions. And I talk about how wealthy the upper management was getting on subprime lending, specifically subprime lending, and how, in fact, they were devastating, these kinds of loans were devastating communities, and at the same time, the CEO was making more money. I mean, his salary was the highest among all of his peers in the financial industry. And so those kinds of things, we must examine them. How do you get that money, and is it, in fact, all legally gained? So I don't know what will happen with criminal prosecutions. I don't really get into that so much in the book, but I wouldn't rule it out.
And finally, I'd like for you, I'm so glad you wrote about it, and you wrote at great length about A Raisin in the Sun and Carl Hansberry's mission to change Chicago's housing restrictions. I love that movie and that play, and it makes me want to go see it again. I want to go rent it. But it obviously really captivated you, Anita, and you spent a lot of time on it. So tell me why.
It captivated me because it so captured for me this desire to find that place where we belong. And that was what the message that I got about the younger family that's at the center of Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun, that desire to belong is a universal desire, but that it has specific dimensions that have to do with the race of the family, as well as the different feelings that the women in the family had about the home and the different role that it played for them. I just think it says so much about America, and has a lot also to teach us about particular individuals in America. And so that the other part of it was that it was one of those, I guess maybe my first view of what the end game for equality would be, that we would all be living together. Maybe there would be tension, but that there would be this community that we all felt that we belonged in. And when the youngers move into this neighborhood that has been segregated, you know that, in fact, there's going to be trouble. But somehow you believe at the end of the play that it's all going to work out. And that's the vision that I had growing up. And that's the vision that I have going into the 21st century.
Really? So you're optimistic? You believe it's all going to work out?
I have to be hopeful, let's say. But I also know that we have a lot of work to do if it's all going to work out.
Hmm. Well, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for the book.
Well, I have enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed the calls, and thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Anytime. Anita Hill, her latest book is Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. She's also the author of Speaking Truth to Power. We think of her at the University of Oklahoma. She hasn't been there for about 13 years now. She's a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. We continue our hour in just a moment with a woman who teaches civil rights and other courses in critical race studies and constitutional law. She has Wisconsin ties. I'll tell you more about her, and we'll continue our phone calls on this issue of home and all that it encompasses in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Kimberly Crenshaw joins us now to continue our conversation on a place called home, on housing discrimination, on the subprime mortgage, and also on Anita Hill, too, and her place in our collective memory. Professor Crenshaw teaches civil rights and other courses in critical race studies and constitutional law at UCLA and also at Columbia. And she has Wisconsin ties. She got her degree at the University of Wisconsin, and she clerked for Chief Justice Shirley Abramson from 1984 to 1985. Professor Crenshaw was a founder and has been a leader in the intellectual movement called Critical Race Theory. She was elected Professor of the Year in 91 and 94 at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She, as I said, clerked for the woman who's now the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Professor Crenshaw has written a number of books, and she was nominated the Fulbright Chair for Latin America and Brazil in 2007, and she is with us now. Her think tank is the African American Policy Forum. Our phone number for her is the same, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Crenshaw, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Let's start with all that has happened for good, the changes that have taken place after Anita Hill testified 20 years ago.
I think it's just undeniable that Anita Hill put sexual harassment on the map. It had been a legal concept that was developed by Catherine McKinnon. Lawyers knew about it. Some plaintiffs knew about it. But generally, the culture did not understand that this kind of behavior, the behavior that Anita Hill complained about, was actually discrimination, workplace discrimination. So the public's awareness of this fact, I think, has just dramatically increased. And at the same time, institutional responsibility for preventing sexual harassment grew, I would say developed and grew after Anita Hill came forward. So, for example, every several years or so, across my computer screen comes a requirement for me to take a course in sexual harassment.
Oh, really?
At UCLA.
Oh.
And they mean it. So you really do have to sit down and learn about what are the things that are prohibited, what are the things that you're required to do, what are the rights of students and coworkers. So I don't think this would have happened had it not been for Anita Hill's courage and for the fact that there was a groundswell across the across many different groups of women to really force this issue and make institutions formally accountable.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what your thoughts were when you watched those hearings. She didn't want to talk about that, but we can certainly talk about that. What did you think of her? What did you think of the whole process?
Well, so I have to say that I was actually there at the hearing.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Oh, so, I didn't know
so
that.
I actually traveled there and just volunteered in any way possible to be supportive. So I was actually watching them from the hearing room and didn't quite get the same sense of it as people who were watching it on television. I can say that these impressions were basically watching the entire thing unfold. And one of the things that I
really was surprised about, and it eventually came out, but you couldn't see it at the time. Behind the scenes, the senators are, you know, they're actually good friends and buddies, and so there was a lot of, you know, backslapping and handshaking and just, you know, not, you didn't really get the sense that this was a highly contested issue around which a black woman's life was being put, you know, for public scrutiny. One didn't get the sense after seeing the hearings that the Democrats, and particularly Joe Biden, went at this nearly in the same way that Arlen Specter did. To put it simply, Clarence Thomas had someone who was both defending him and someone who was prosecuting for him. Anita Hill didn't have that same level of engagement and support on the part of the Judiciary Committee. And the imbalance that that created, I think, became obvious as the hearings wore on.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing? She was talking to us about the number of letters, 25,000 letters she has received, with people telling her about their own, not only sexual discrimination, but problems, race issues and gender issues. Mm-hmm. So many people wanted to be in touch with her.
Yes, it's not surprising at all. And I'll tell you more that there are those who've been doing some data studies on the changing attitude in the American public about whether they believed Anita Hill. And in the years after the hearings, that number has gone up. And many people speculate it's because individuals who experienced something like that but didn't tell anyone or didn't think anyone would believe them or didn't even have a name for it were prompted to say, well, that happened to me, and to tell family members and friends and coworkers. So having someone tell you something like that has happened and having the opportunity to inquire, well, why didn't you say anything or why didn't you step forward, and people telling the real reasons why they didn't say anything or why they didn't step forward, it had the effect, I think, of making Anita Hill's story real to millions of people, and therefore people began to change their mind about some of the doubt that they had about her story.
There's also something about her. She strikes me, I've never had a chance to speak with her before, but having read her book or good chunks of it yesterday, there's something about her sensibilities, about her honesty and straightforwardness and her life that you have to respect, don't you?
Absolutely. You know, and that's what was actually so frustrating and revealing about how the political and media process can remake someone.
Yes.
Because if you even have the most casual opportunity to meet Anita, you see her as a person of integrity, a person who is, you know, socially, you know, conservative. She's not a person who would, you know, want to jump in the middle of the fray simply to, you know, make a point against Clarence Thomas, someone, you know, who it exercises all of the presentation of decorum, and then to have her be reconstructed by various people in the media, either as being love crazed and or politically motivated, or on the other hand, as one commentator put it, you know, she couldn't have been offended by this because, you know, any African American woman knows that this is just down home courting. You know, just denied her the right to be who she was and to, in fact, be offended by unwelcome sexual advances. So it was remarkable to see what the media can do, what the political machinery can do, and at the same time miraculous to see that so many people could see through that, see the person who she really was, and that she was able to continue being the person she really is.
And she highlights a lot, because she tells so many stories in the book about subprime mortgage and people who were predatory lending, you know, these places where you have to buy everything, and then if you're late on your payment, they want to repossess everything.
Mm-hmm.
What is it this bugs the heck out of me, Professor Crenshaw, but it, sometimes the truth seems so obvious if you read everything, and you must really feel this in the profession that you're in, how you can have a truth and all evidence points to a truth, and yet there are a couple truths. You see it in everything, in all these issues, in Anita Thomas, in the law, too, in how we interpret things, in the media, and how we frame things.
Yeah.
What about the truth?
Well, you know, that has really been battered lately. You know, there is that old saying that a lie goes around the world before the truth puts its boots on. and there is a continuing reality to that. And at the same time, you know, we have to recognize that, you know, truths are often socially constructed. They are politically constructed. They're culturally constructed. By that I mean people have narrative frames upon which they rely to understand things. And if there is a fact or a truth that does not fit within the narrative frame that people have, they have no place to store it. They have no way to really credit it. It doesn't even come across the transom. So, you know, when we look at any number of issues having to do with inequality, race, gender, class, we've been fed a frame over the last 20 years that we're beyond all those issues, that if there are inequalities around race or if the subprime lending fiasco has disproportionately affected black and brown communities, it's not that they were targeted. It's not that, you know, this was predatory. It's just that those people were unqualified.
Right.
They were reckless. They were stupid. When you don't have a frame that makes discrimination, makes predatory conduct current, then you default to the idea that these are the products of individual wrongdoing, misbehavior, or just recklessness. So one of the reasons why it's important for us to revisit things like Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, and other moments is that it reactivates the frame that there are structures of discrimination that are still existing, and therefore there are people who are still being victimized by it. They're not victimizing themselves.
Yeah. And it goes beyond the individual. It goes, communities are not victimized.
Entire communities are victimized. There are studies that show that this period has been the largest period of wealth transfer from African-American communities to white communities. Other studies are showing now that the net wealth, the median net wealth for black women is $5. So we're talking about a massive hemorrhaging of economic well-being. And, you know, whatever happens in a community happens to you, whether you're making your mortgage payments or not. This is like an economic virus. It's something that you can't simply protect yourself from paying your mortgage on time or doing whatever the script is that says these are the successful people and these are not. These are community issues. These are ecological issues. They're not just individual issues.
Do you share Anita Hill's optimism, which she shared at the end of the show, that she does believe that it's all going to work out?
Well, I believe that it works out when and if people have the right understanding about what the problem is. So the fact that Anita Hill is out there and doing what she's doing, the fact that she still has a podium, an audience that is willing to listen and pay attention, the fact that, you know, there are thousands of people on Wall Street right now.
Right.
I mean, these are the things that give me hope. These are the things that make me think that, you know, as long as there is a discourse alive and people are feeling empowered to take action to follow it up, that gives me a sense that things can turn around. When we stop having the language to talk about these things and the belief that doing so actually changes things, that's when I become pessimistic.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at all those people, I mean, it's just amazing to me that that people are everywhere, all over the world. Mm-hmm. What is the outcome of that? Where does that go?
Well, you know, again, I think it's very difficult to predict with any certainty where things will go. I mean, one of the things we've learned from history is that there have been many moments where the opportunity for change and reform seemed ripe, but one doesn't know until the aftermath of it, whether the ingredients were enough to sustain something, to focus in a way these energies towards ends that were clear enough and that could deliver real change. So I try not to over expect, because with over expectation comes disappointment. I do think that without these efforts, there really is no possibility that the many kind of changes in consciousness and the changes in how things work won't happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm delighted that what globalization has actually brought is the recognition that what's happening on this corner is connected with what's happening not just across the street or across town, but across the world.
Yeah, and we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Anytime. We could talk to you about everything. Thank you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Professor Kimberly Crenshaw teaches civil rights in courses in critical race studies at UCLA and at Columbia, got her law degree at Madison, and was a clerk for now Supreme Court Justice Shirley Abramson. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for putting this great show together. Till tomorrow.